Members of this conference of the Associates of Brown University, invited guests, students and faculty of Brown University, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure to open the second session of this conference on the Vatican Council and the world of today. We are also pleased this evening to be able to extend the hearing for this conference to those who are listening on the WBRU-FM station, and to alert them at least to the possibility that tomorrow evening at 7:30 it will be possible for them to hear the first session this afternoon. As you know, we have tried to, this afternoon and again this evening, to focus on two issues which were both among the central concerns of Vatican II and of significant importance not only for the life of the Roman Church, but indeed for all men everywhere. It is clear to us that conscience and freedom constitutes such an issue in modern life, and that Father Herring is eminently qualified to lead our thinking in this area. The strong interest of the American participants in Vatican II with respect to the Declaration on Religious Freedom reflects the concern of a very wide segment of the American public in the personal and constitutional dimensions of conscience and freedom. I cannot help, however, but consider the peculiar appropriateness of the setting which Brown University and especially the state of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations provides for such a discussion. And those of us who are the citizens of this state must stand perforce in the spiritual lineage of a great prophet of religious liberty in the 17th century, Roger Williams, who in such writings as The Bloody Tenant and The Bloody Tenant Yet More Bloody could argue with the civil authorities that virtue gives no right to impose one's definitions on others. He would have been very sympathetic with the statement in the Declaration on Religious Freedom that the truth cannot impose itself except by virtue of its own truth as it makes its entrance into the mind at once quietly and with power. I know that many of you hoped this afternoon that you would have more opportunity for your participation in the life of the conference, and I can assure you that Father Herring hopes very much that you will take advantage of this opportunity following his address this evening. It is my very great privilege and pleasure at this time to present to you Father Bernard Herring, who will address the conference on conscience and freedom. Father Herring.
Ladies and gentlemen, several polls showed that the two words most dear to our contemporaries are freedom and conscience. These words belong to the highest Christian values, and if we make a common effort to understand them better, these two words and the great truth, the great values behind them, will allow us a more fruitful dialogue among the different churches, and even a more fruitful dialogue between believers and unbelievers. Conscience and freedom are fundamental values, and they must be dear to everyone who believes in the gospel. It is for freedom, says St. Paul, that Christ has liberated you. And ever, the gospel makes appeal to man's own conscience, to his free assent. But in order to relate these two values together, we must know each one in its own meaning. What is conscience and what is freedom? And how are they related to each other? Men have different ways to have a conscience. We must realize this. There are all too many Christians and non-Christians who have a conscience which is described by the school of Durkheim, the great sociologist, who thinks that conscience is to conform with a social pattern, to avoid difficulties. Does it not often happen if little Harry or little Mary are asking mother, father, why? That mother tells them, obey. Mother, father knows it better. And the boy or the girl learn to adjust themselves, to conform, in order to avoid pressure. And so they do sometimes in their parish, and they seem to be good little boys, good adolescents. And if they change their environment, they have the same way of having conscience. They are conscious of possible tensions, difficulties, and they adjust themselves, are obedient towards the stronger pattern. This is not a true conscience. This is not more than a sociological superego. There is another way of conscience which comes already nearer to what should conscience be, but is not yet fully a developed conscience, namely the consciousness that authority is good. But it can become one-sided. And we must face this problem because in the whole matter of religious liberty, this is one of the greatest burdens of the history. Religious liberty was extremely difficult in Europe because of these twofold traditions, the Roman and the German. In the Roman Empire, the emperor was at the same time the political leader and the high priest. And he decided not only political matters, he decided religious matters. And when Constantine became Christian without being baptized, he continued the old pattern. And in German, oldest German tradition among all the Germanic tribes was the fundamental value of absolute Gefolgschaftstreue, absolute fidelity towards the leaders, towards the princes. The whole conscience was almost totally reduced to this one appeal: follow in all events your leader, your prince. They had some consciousness, value of fidelity, but restricted to this one, in many cases, it destroyed the conscience. There is another way of having conscience. One sees many moral laws, moral principles. They are exactly worded. And there is some consciousness that behind these values is a legislator. But often the principles, the laws, are hiding the one who is legislator, or reveal him only as legislator. And thus arises a conscience in moral questions which does not joyfully follow these principles. Paul Claudel, the great French poet and the man who had great intuition into human psychology, expresses the attitude of so many Catholics of his environment who say, surely we love Christ, but nothing in the world makes us like morals. Namely, these many, many principles related to God only as legislator. There is another kind of having conscience, where you see laws, but there is a fundamental, deep conviction of the goodness of authority. Child, trusting father and mother, seeing that father and mother are indeed good, and because they are good, it feels what they tell the child is good. But then, if conscience should develop, it should also learn to discern where father and mother are indeed good and where they are less good. You can compare humanity with the childhood. In the childhood of humanity, it was an appropriate way of having conscience, some paternalism. It seems to suffice to people to know God is good, and he tells us this and that without making any effort to understand why he does tell us in this way. But childhood has to make place to manhood. And when the fullness of the time came, this is one of the greatest and evident changes of conscience, as Christ expresses it in the warm environment of the Last Supper, when he proclaims his new law, "This is my appeal to you, love one another as I have loved you." Then he points this out. "I call you servants no longer, because a servant, a slave, does not know what his master is about. I call you dear friends, because I have disclosed to you whatever the Father has disclosed to me." There is the conscience of Christians under the gospel. And this conscience under the gospel is prepared by many who do not know the gospel explicitly, but have a similar way of approaching things. They are prepared by a father and mother who patiently and wisely explain to the child why, and help the adolescent to distinguish what is indeed fully good, to help to find out the signs of discernment of what is good, what is less good, and what is unacceptable. The true conscience, the moral conscience and the religious conscience, is faced with values, a deep understanding of what is goodness, of what is gentleness, of what is vigilance for the needs, for the real needs of one's neighbor, what is justice, what is self-control, what is the purity of the intentions, the unselfish way of loving each other. They are values, not only laws and principles. But the conscience is fully developed in a way as we Christians understand it, if behind these values, which lead also to principles, if behind these values is a person, the absolute person who is love, then that all these values are a speech, are an appeal, are a message of the one who is love, who is all goodness, and can to appeal to us then as the Lord does in the Sermon on the Mount, the Gospel of Matthew, when he summarizes everything in this one word, be all goodness as your heavenly Father is all good. There are different ways, even under the gospel. There are different ways among believers to develop conscience. And here we must give full appreciation, full justice to some who are not yet believers in our sense, who do not yet know Christ and his gospel, and yet have sometimes a greater sensibility for gentleness, for kindness, for goodness, for serviceable love than those who know Christ, acknowledge him as the one who brought the gospel and the will of God. It's always, always humiliating for us, humbling us if we see that a man under the gospel is not sensitive enough for the values. We must be deeply ashamed that Christians could sell and buy other men into slavery. They could go to church and worship and keep their fellow men in chains. We must be deeply ashamed how conscience, even of those who claim to be Christians, can be blinded. But this cannot happen if one indeed is deeply faced with a living God. Always these persons who looked to God in his own goodness, who looked to Christ, who made manifest the full extent of God's love, they were always awakened. They always were stronger than the social pattern, the tendencies of selfish men. Conscience, what is conscience finally? There are among the schools of our own church different theories. The one think they are inborn principles. The other, it is the inborn love towards the good. My own opinion in this matter is, it is totality of man. And the more man grows to oneness, the more he grows mature, he feels in conscience that all the strength of his soul are claiming him to the good. It is the intellect open to the world of the values and finally open to the one who is alone good. But the intellect can be open only because the heart is open, because he's a loving person. One cannot be fully open for the light and warmth of the values and finally of the one who appeals to all these values if he is not a loving person. Conscience is this totalness of man where the deepest depth cries towards oneness, oneness between what he understands as being good and what he wishes to fulfill. If one is obedient, finally, to his own knowledge of what is good, and if one earnestly evermore tries to understand what is the good in order to fulfill it. What is freedom? There are different levels of freedom. Having faced slavery under Hitler, having seen the Soviet paradise during several years, we appreciate very highly civil freedom. That is, a whole structure of society and state where everyone's person everyone's freedom is respected. Where he is not used as a means, where he is a dignity, where he is a value in himself. It is a value, the political freedom of a nation, but only if the nation gives freedom to its citizens. But it's not only this freedom. If we speak on freedom, freedom which grants the public authority towards every individual, freedom means also to be free from unworthy dependence from the social pattern, that one can face himself with truth, that one allows himself to think, to research what is indeed the good. One must be free from blind obedience, where he overgives himself, where he surrenders his own conscience to another and let him decide on the deepest questions of his life. Finally, we mean moral freedom, and moral freedom means that one has the internal power to love the good. If one has all the energies to carry out what is bad, he's not a free man. He's a slave of his idols, of his selfishness, of an ideology. One is free if he can understand in a growing way what is good and has the choice, the internal possibility to love the good. It is already much if a man at least has the freedom to desire to be good, to have a deep desire to do the good, even if there are psychological and social obstacles which from time to time hinder him to fulfill it in the action. To moral freedom belongs it, does it also belong that one is allowed to fulfill an even imperfect knowledge. You may know the famous word Cardinal Newman repeated often, and he insisted that in his Apologia Pro Vita Sua that it was and remains one of his fundamental principles. And he says, "I have always contended that obedience even to an erring conscience is the way to gain light. There is no other possibility for us men than to be obedient towards our upright conscience." But, as Cardinal Newman expresses it, a true conscience, an upright conscience, always tries to gain light, to grow in knowledge, to come into better contact with the good. In the council discussions on religious freedom was ever and ever heard from the traditionalist minority, error has no right. It is evident that error has no right, but if man follows from this that an erring person has no right, then none of us would have any right on the world, because every one of us in some items is erring at least for some time of his life. And nobody should confuse himself with truth, absolute truth. There is only one who is the truth. With the principle, error has no right, they burned each other in the medieval time or in the new epoch, within the same church, Inquisition, and they started war against each other. Error has no right. It is true an upright conscience always try to overcome error. It is one of the deepest concerns of every man who has conscience, true conscience, that he always tries to gain light, to use the expression of Cardinal Newman. But he tries to gain light, to come nearer to light. A consequence of the principle that error has no right must be that we are researching together to gain light, to come to the full light, that men must remain in dialogue with each other. Man is not capable to make such an absolute judgment on others to say he is totally confused and totally identified with error. And what does it help if one or a group would urge on others to do what they cannot understand and acknowledge as the good? Would the good be done? Moral values are accomplished only if one accomplishes them out of own appreciation, out of his own freedom, out of his own conscience. And therefore, if one says error has no right, that obliges him to a common effort to gain light. This is necessary even within the same church. And we are convinced also in our Catholic Church, renewed and ever ready to gain light in many items, that we have not solutions for all things, that we must be patient and strive constantly. The Constitution of the Church of the modern world in Article 43 emphasizes these questions, that the faithful should not think that the hierarchy has always solutions, even for grave problems. Then everyone or every group altogether have to make their effort, and everyone for his own particular situation. The text says, often enough, the Christian view of things will itself suggest some specific solution in certain circumstances. Yet it happens rather frequently, and legitimately so, that with equal sincerity, some of the faithful will disagree with others on a given matter. Even against the intention of their proponents, however, solutions proposed on one side or another may be easily confused by many people with the gospel message. Hence, it is necessary for the people to remember that no one is allowed in the church's aforementioned situations to appropriate the church's authority for his opinion. They should always try to enlighten one another through honest discussion, preserving mutual charity, and caring above all the common good. With this article is acknowledged what to all eyes became evident in the council, that there is a certain pluralism within the Catholic Church. There is unity, fundamental unity, and can reign full charity in disagreement on several points. But the unity imposes a common effort to gain light, to understand what is the best possible way to serve God in certain circumstances or in great problems of the time. The respect for the other, one other's freedom must be based on humility. So often men claim that they are following their conscience and have only a superficial opinion. We should all be concerned for truth and for true conscience and distinguish our superficial opinions with our deepest convictions. freedom has different levels. The gospel speaks on the blessed freedom of the sons and daughters of God. It is the fullest freedom, where one has surrendered his will to God, but not in order to a slavish obedience, but he has surrendered his intelligence and will to God in order to meditate day and night on his gospel, to understand ever better God's loving will. He has nothing else in mind than to be God's sharer in love to his neighbor. This is the blessed freedom of the sons and daughters of God. And if one has this fundamental approach, I am delighted in the loving will of God. I meditate on it day and night. And if he's vigilant, then his understanding of the moral values are growing. And it is easy for him even to follow an appeal which imposes on him great generosity. We are finally now to speak on the great item of religious liberty, which in my eyes was worthwhile to gather a council to deliberate us finally from the heavy burden of the Roman emperors, who remained in almost the same attitude when they became superficially baptized. They still continued to impose their political opinion as a religious opinion. So the East Roman emperors persecuted the one year the Catholics, the other year the Arians. In both cases, they did it out of political reasons. And then the great burden of the absolute fidelity of the Germanic world towards the princes. And we all must be ashamed, all Christians together, must be ashamed that after a history of almost 1,000 years Christianity, there was no loud outcry of Christianity when the princes of the Roman Empire of German nation decided that every prince has the right of reformation. That means the right to impose his own creed. The whole Christianity should have cried out that princes claim to have the right to decide on the religious creed of their faithful. And it was an agreement of Christianity, which disagreed on so many points, to agree each other this right to impose on his citizens his creed. And so it happens in Rheinpfalz, in one of the states of the empire, that during one generation they had to change 5 times their creed, because 5 times the changes of the dynasty were different beliefs. It is the deep burden of a Christianization in Spain imposing on the Jews and on the Muslims either to immigrate or to be baptized. And many prefer to be baptized externally in order to remain in their fatherland. And against them came then the Inquisition. Once more, power structure, not in the name of the church, in the name of the emperor. But the great confusion arose in the church through the fact that Otto the Great made the bishops and abbots princes of his empire, and that the Pope had on his neck his own state. And so they became involved in these tendencies of two dangerous traditions so totally opposed to the gospel. Through all the centuries, there were Christian men courageous enough for an outcry against this, but it was time that finally a council settled the question and made clear where is the real truth, the right attitude, absolute respect, namely towards the conscience. This must first be clear within the structures, in the attitude of the church herself. The church cannot allow her any power structure or any trick in order to make believers. Salvation comes from free acceptance of faith. And it is the highest obligation of the church to trust totally the gospel and divine grace. And any effort to impose faith or to use tricks, to use power, is an offense against the liberating power of the gospel of God's grace. Faith has value only as a free yes, a free, joyful, grateful acceptance of the gospel, of the liberating truth. So must also be the community of the faithful. In this whole community of the faithful in the church must shine forth the real freedom for which Christ has set us free. That is the power, the liberating power of the witness of a life under the gospel. It is the great power, the liberating power of a deep knowledge of Christ, of an ever-growing knowledge of the values which are conveyed to us through God, the Creator and the Redeemer. It is one of the greatest power, the greatest dangers for faith if men of the church trust more in earthly means than in the divine grace, in the gospel which is given us through God. So it is not only that the church speaks for others and tells them, you have to respect our freedom. The first item is within the church, to make it absolutely visible how great is the respect for conscience, how great the respect for true, genuine freedom. And this is by no means indifferentism. It is based, totally based, on the respect, the reverence towards the gospel truth. It is based in respect for every man created to the image and likeness of God. This same respect for the conscience must then be the leitmotif, the guiding principle in our relationship from person to person. Allow me to touch the most crucial and most burning example on this behalf, namely mixed marriages. I hope that the Catholic Church will soon come out with an appropriate legislation which was voted in the council but given over for a more careful wording and pastoral application. It is evident in the light of Second Vatican Council what was evident for all illumined Christians before that, that in such a deep relationship as is marriage, a covenant of love, the most basic condition is mutual respect for the conscience. It would destroy the very essence, the very foundation of a marriage as a covenant of love between two persons, if the one would have his victory over the conscience of the others in a way that the other would promise something against his conscience, against his deep convictions. If the two consciences are so deeply separated that they cannot agree each other, full respect to live out of his own conscience, there is no other possibility for these two persons than to separate before they have founded this covenant of love, before they run into the indissoluble bond. That is the best way to love each other if they have not a passionate love only, not only a drive, if they revere each other as persons. The only decision can then only be if you do not agree, cannot freely, from your own conviction, agree on this fundamental point to leave to me full freedom to live my own faith, there can no question be, this question cannot be settled then by power or by threatening or by crying. There are then problems, moral problems. How far can our legislation be revised? The legislation in the church shows here also great variety. In the different epochs, the one principle is always evident, that no one can ever sacrifice his conviction to another because of a marriage. But on the question of education of children, there is a rather interesting approach during the history. The minimum in my eyes is that the two, respecting absolutely the conviction of the other, agree on this point that they also will absolutely respect the conscience of the children whenever they will make their free choice and will not make any pressure on the children. Finally, religious freedom is explained in terms of the state, and it was necessary, as I explained, in view of the heavy burden coming from the Roman emperors and from the Germanic princes. The heavy burden of the time of Reformation, anti-Reformation, when the princes of the Catholic and Protestant belief claimed to have the right to impose their creed with violence, with all kind of tricks and chains and jail. In view of this happening of the past time, the council had to do a great work of patience. Most of my American friends were very impatient that they did not obtain a formal voting in the second session. I disagreed with them. I disliked some maneuvers from the other side, but I felt it would be a death-bringing victory from our part just to obtain a voting and to obtain 67% and to impose on the others. If we wish to settle the principle, we have to be patient and to use the patient means of conviction to show what is on stake, to help the other to understand what was needed. And so we had to go through the third session with deep frustrations of our American friends. But I think we all who were concerned used the time. We approached the conservative bishops. We spoke to the journalists and tried to explain what it meant. And it was better then to obtain a final voting on the first session against 75 who had not yet understood than if we would have obtained the victory over 600 bishops who had not understood. The very principle on stake obliged us to a patient work of persuasion, to use good arguments and not power. And for the future of this principle, it is decisive that it is not a victory of 67% that finally we came to an almost unanimous consent. And not even this is decisive. Decisive is that meantime the same spirit is embodied in all constitution and decrees of the council. This means more than to have an easily victory. And I'm convinced that this principle of religious freedom, which declares so evidently the incompetence of the state to settle religious questions, which appeals to the state to fulfill his own task, namely to guarantee the atmosphere of full freedom and respect for every person, that this principle is most decisive for a fruitful dialogue of the believers with the unbelievers. And I'm convinced that we have removed through this an obstacle which men had posed to the liberating power of the gospel. Have you questions or objections? We are free to disagree. Please.
Yes, ma'am. I didn't quite understand your statement on the freedom of the
Well, for the minimum, I consider for a Catholic, he has to obtain. Mixed marriages are not advisable, if there is a conflict between the two, if they cannot agree. But often it is a question to renounce or not renounce to a marriage, or to renounce to the only one man who is a good man or a good woman. And then the minimum in my eyes is that the non-Catholic partner promises or leaves the freedom to the Catholic partner to give his wisdom, to live his faith and to give his wisdom, his witness of a Christian life, a joyful life. If later on then the child wishes to become Catholic, that at least he will not then block the freedom of the child. This is a minimum in my eyes, the minimum for future legislation. And from both sides, it is against the principle of religious freedom, what happened under my own eyes from both churches in Germany, that children with 12, 13 years were just told by the parents, we have now settled our question, tomorrow you are Lutheran or tomorrow you are Catholic, without the free consent of the children. This destroys faith in the children. That is just a change imposed without their own conviction. This cannot be made. But if the children, and it often happens that the child was 12, 13 years, has already its own conviction, and it grows in him, and finally it declares, I wish to make my choice, then also the parents have to leave absolute freedom. They cannot claim, you have promised me this. It's never good to keep one under the statistics of faith if there is not a real conviction.
There's a question in the rear.
Father Herring, you talked about the problem of freedom within the church, the freedom of the Catholic within the structure of the church. I'm particularly interested in your opinions about the position of priests within the church, because as you may know, we've had some interesting discussion about this in this country. There's a priest in California, Father Dubé, who was interested in founding a union for priests. And I'm not saying that I'm advocating that, but I'm interested in your thoughts about the possibility of making much clearer legislation so that the freedom of priests within the church would be guaranteed.
The Constitution on the Church insists very much, it is in the second chapter of the second part, that both laymen and clerics should enjoy freedom in the church. First, it was, the text said, emphasized very much the freedom of the faithful, and we in the commission thought that the priests also belong to the faithful. but then some bishops asked, it should be made clear that the priests enjoy the same freedom as the other faithful, freedom in researching the truth and to express humbly and courageous their opinions. So the Magna Carta is absolutely sure for both, for laity and priests. Well, nevertheless, must be some discipline. If one accepts to do ministry, he then must also carry out this ministry in loyalty towards his own church. This loyalty towards his church, if he has a ministry, can oblige a priest to be very evidently disobedient to a disobedient prelate. If his superior is unloyal and opposed, let's say, for the whole approach, the council, and forbids to carry it out, the priest, by loyalty of his ministry, must disobey. Show his loyalty towards the full authority of the church. And there are always matters which are matters where discussions can arise. And in these cases of legitimate dissensions, where not the fundamental structure of loyalty is in question, the superiors should never try to stifle the research or opinions through administration. If they are sure that the man is wrong, they should also try the means of persuasion. I do not judge now on single cases. I only wish to say that I personally have no sympathy for trade unions of priests. I always felt to be a very free man without such a trade union.
Are there further questions? This gentleman right here.
Father, you spoke about the indissoluble bond of marriage. I wonder if this concept of freedom could be somewhat extended. We say, for example, that indissoluble bond results from a rotum et consummatum marriage, where the consent and the physical union is achieved. Is it possible that in such a marriage, rotum et consummatum, that because of physical, psychological, sexual incompatibility, there may not be a true marriage? That the church perhaps is basing its stand on the indissolubility of marriage on a biological description of the union in marriage. Is it possible that some kind of annulment might be given in a rotum et consummatum marriage that might be based on psychological incompatibility that would make the marriage not complete?
Well, casuistic questions, how far a marriage included a real consent, a real mutual acceptance, they are always open questions, and it is evident that the Roman Rota in its decisions was mostly much more progressive than the American tribunals, and many frictions arose from this. But as to sexual incompatibility, I would be very cautious. It is an item in this continent. The problem is not so felt in other countries. Through overemphasis in public opinion, so often after a bad cooking of coffee, the husband thinks that he is sexual or psychologically incompatible. So I would not be in favor of these extensions.
There's a question here, Monsignor Gagan.
Father, I quite agree with you on your statement about what you would consider to be the minimum with respect to freedom within marriage, namely the right of both spouses to their religion of their choice, and the fact that religion should not be imposed upon a child who has reached such an age that he is now at a point to make some decision on his own. But now, would you, surely you would not be implying that, let's say, between the child, the time of the child's birth, and the time that the child is 12 or 13, when he is now asked to make a choice, that he would sort of grow up in a religious vacuum? Or would you?
Let's take now the example of a 7 or 8 old year child. Even there, if the parents decide for themselves to make a change, even there the most delicate respect for the religious feelings of the child are necessary. And only if the child understands, if it imposed something just brutally, you have to do this, it would always endanger the whole approach of this child towards religion, ever religion, especially then toward the religion of these parents. So it's always here a matter of the deepest respect, where the highest value of faith is in stake. There always must be the deepest respect and the deepest conviction that it is God's grace which decides, not some trick. Deepest respect. That doesn't exclude the explanation. That includes the explanation, but in full respect. But I think for the decision of the education of the children, in my opinion, a Catholic, and I think Episcopalian would think as I do, if he can be, get married with a boy of, or a man of the same faith, with no conflict on this behalf, they should rather prefer not to have a mixed marriage. But sometimes, there are often minority of one church, a small minority, they could not hope reasonably to obtain a marriage with an honest, good a man or a woman of the same faith who is worthy to be loved and have a chance to get married with another person. And the question is then, if they cannot obtain from the other person the promise of religious education, must they then, through their whole life, renounce to a marriage? Under the opinion of Finney and Boston and his friends, that all who are non-Catholics go to hell, it was evident that then a Catholic was obliged rather to renounce to marriage because it was not good to have children who went to hell. But if we have now other convictions, and good Catholics had always other convictions, we see that they can be educated in other faith to a real love of God and to great goodness, and can reach eternal salvation, then I feel it is not then a necessity for this girl to, without any vocation for celibacy. Let's take the cases of Japan or Sweden, where are so few Catholics. We cannot say it is for better them to burn without marriage, than to have children who, as good Lutherans, are reaching salvation. But the minimum, if she appreciates and she loves her faith, is that she is allowed to give the witness, to live her faith joyfully, and to give the witness, and if a child then freely wishes to become Catholic, that it should be allowed. That is the minimum, what in my eyes, and I wrote this in before the council in the article Mixed Marriage in Lexikon für Theologie und Kirche. This minimum which would be required, and I feel that every theologian, open-minded theologian of other churches, would acknowledge the same minimum. This question is old already in the provincial council of Elvira, about 306. There were two redactions. And always in the document in Mansi, it came the two redactions, and there is always discussions which is the official. It seems that already at that time there were two parties, and we cannot make out which was the majority. The one said is if there are more girls than Catholic boys, the one redaction is better for them to get married with a non-Catholic than to burn in adultery. And the other redaction said if there are more girls than men, it is better for her not to get married than to burn in idolatry. There were a very violent confrontation of the two parties. Later on, the Council of Laodicea, about 370, warned for mixed marriages. They should be made with discernment. With discernment. And the Second Council of Constantinople made it obligatory for the subdeacons and deacons to educate, to raise their children in the Catholic faith. Oh, it was a special prohibition for deacons and subdeacons to get married without this promise. You see how careful the approaches were sometimes. It depended very much from the possibilities. We can say we see throughout the whole history this minimum approach, but as to the other, we see the great influence of the environment and the conditions. Thank you very much for your attention, for your participation.